At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams, whew,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. It is Friday, and amazingly, we start off this Friday with some pretty good news on the jobs numbers, the economy adding a whole lot of jobs and then revising the number from December. So, Tim Miller, we can start on a high note. By the way, good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Charlie. Starting on a note of optimism. That's fresh. I kind of feel like there's a bait and switch coming or something. Used to this cheery tone from you to start.
Well, I figured we would just sort of set the table with this. Although it occurs to me, looking at these numbers, is it possible the Bureau of Labor Statistics just isn't very good at this? you know what I'm saying? It's like everybody was like, the entire narrative was how terrible December was. It was really terrible. And they go, hey, never mind. Actually, the economy created more than 500,000 jobs in December. Our bad.
So, yeah, you know, here's where my old Republican might come out, Charlie. I do think that government bureaucracies sometimes aren't as good as they might make themselves out to be. I know that this is going to be a shocking observation to you. I want to go back and revisit something when I realized this about the Bureau of Labor and Statistics. And it was when I was doing something that kind of fills me with a little bit of shame now. But I was a young man working at the Republican National Committee. And, you know, and Barack Obama's in office, and every month these numbers come out, and every month you got to put out a statement that's like, well, the jobs weren't not, where are the jobs, President Obama? And, you know, it was kind of one of the parts of the job I really hated, because I was like, I don't want to have to put anything out about this. It seems kind of stupid and performative, but, you know, there was pressure from on high. And one thing I started to notice as we did this was, like, the revisions are very common. it's from voluntary form the businesses some fill out. Sometimes the form businesses don't fill out the form. You know, it has the same problem that polls do. So as far as margin of error, so one Friday a month, the first Friday of every month, people get all hot and bothered about this. And it is always best to kind of wait a few months. So that doesn't really serve our political and media purposes.
And it's also not possible. Maybe they're just having a particularly hard time, though, counting jobs during the pandemic. Revisions
half are million off is pretty bad.
So we can talk about the China. We don't see any genocide Olympics a little while.
One more thing on the jobs.
Before we dive into the dysfunction.
Yeah,
dystopia.
There was an encouraging number, though, about the labor participation rate. Again, you know, hopefully that doesn't get revised back down last month. But one of the, you know, issues, you know, in the economic recovery is, you know, it's been kind of weird, right, is that the market's doing good. You know, the unemployment number is looking good, you know, but there's been this sort of displacement and this lack of matching of people getting back into the workforce. And so while the unemployment number has gone down, like the number of people in the workforce hasn't really changed all that much. It's ticked up a little bit. That changed a lot in this last report. Now, again, hopefully we just said maybe there'll be a revision, but I was happy to see Klain this morning was touting that. And I've been happy to see the Biden administration touting that because and that is really where, you know, that's going to have an impact on the inflation, right? Part of the thing that's driving up prices for people is the lack of folks getting back into the workforce and getting back to the kind of workforce participation rate we had before the pandemic. So I was happy to see them touting that, and that if that continues this year, would be good news. So knock on wood for that.
It could. Get back to me in April. We'll look at these numbers. So as I said, we're about to have the we don't see any genocide Olympics in China. I tweeted out snarkily this morning. I said, you know, remember when we said never again, we will never again avert our eyes from genocide. Apparently it came with an asterisk. And unless there are the Olympics, there's games, big TV contracts. And it's China. Apparently we just treat China like it's in a box. Doesn't it feel like China's in a box that if anybody else tried this shit, that it would play out differently, but it's China. And like, I don't know. NBA's got to play. It's like, you know, got to sell movies. What?
Yeah, I've been saying this for months. I really don't get it. I'd feel bad for the athletes, right? The Olympics is, you know, a lot of these sports, right? These are not the same as, you know, your big major team sports where the athletes, you know, have a lot of chances to shine. It's only every 4 years, right? So, you know, that might be right in your peak as an athlete. So I do feel bad for the athletes. But it kind of seems like the old college sports thing where people said, well, you do feel bad for the student athletes, but we're going to keep paying them nothing. It doesn't seem like we're really participating in it because people care about the athletes' feelings. It does, you know, seem more about all of the corporate and financial windfall that surrounds it. I mean, that's not an obvious take, but Beijing, I said this last time on the live stream, and folks, we welcomed Will Salatin to the live stream. So if you're not a Bulwark Plus member, join and go listen to that because we covered a lot of ground. But they had this fucking thing in 2008. Like, it definitely seems like the Chinese are gaming the system with the IOC. They just had the Olympics, you know, what's that, 15 years ago? You know, there are a lot of countries on Earth. I don't understand why the West is not flexing their muscle and saying no, you know, to this type of thing. We shouldn't be participating in this. It's not only the genocide, but it's Hong Kong. It's the way they're menacing Taiwan. It's Tibet. It's the virus.
Yeah, they have the virus
they lied about. You know, this little virus that killed millions of people that they lied about and were responsible for. I haven't seen them take responsibility for that and apologize and try to reform so that the next time there's a coronavirus that spurs out of somewhere in China, that they're going to act differently. I don't see an argument for participating in this, besides the feelings of the athletes, which I do feel bad for, but the rest of it.
Yeah, right. I feel the same thing. I really, you know, given the fact that it's only once every 4 years and they work so hard and they don't get a lot of other rewards for it. So yes, I feel for them, but the thing is such a ridiculous farce.
Yes. And tonight they're going to have the opening ceremonies. It's tonight, right? Or is it tomorrow?
I'm skipping it, so it's not. It's not on my
exactly
dance
what
card.
It's going to be. It is going to be just this
rah rah China.
Yeah, rah rah China, Chino jingoism. And look, I was happy that Biden made some steps, you know, to not have a diplomatic corps or whatever, you know, participate in the charade. But I did think it was a kind of an opportunity for him to take back some of the nationalistic fervor. I haven't seen any polling data on this, so I might be wrong. But I do think that there are opportunities for them to signal that they are tough on China, because they are. It doesn't feel like the Democrats' rhetoric matches their actions on this, because the Biden has kept the Trumpian tariffs on China. And if you listen, if you like pay close attention to, you know, speeches that don't make the headlines, you know, the rhetoric is not kind to Xi. It's frankly tougher than what Trump used to say about him. But, you know, you don't see the big statement of principle, and a big attempt to, you know, stick a middle finger into China's eye, which they deserve. You know, it's just like, if it was Richly. Just the virus, that would be one thing. The virus is bad enough, but they're one of the most repressive regimes in the world. I just don't understand why we're giving them this platform.
Well, I agree. Okay. So this is Friday.
Yeah.
And this is the week. It has been less than a week since the former president of the United States actually stood up and dangled pardons for the insurrectionists of January 6th. It has been less than a week since the former president of the United States, reading off the teleprompter, threatened mass demonstrations and unrest if prosecutors tried to hold him accountable. We have learned all sorts of things this week, including about possible plan to have the federal government seize voting machines. We know a little bit more now about the way those faked and forged electoral certificates might have been used to overturn the election. By the way, his phrase, overturn the election. So I kind of want to put a line under this. Like, people, I know we've been dealing with this for a long time, but this is fucking insane stuff. But just in case you don't think it's fucking insane enough, the Republican National Committee today, in this week when all of this is going on, is passing a resolution censuring Adam Kinzinger and Liz Cheney, the two Republicans who are honest enough to want to find out the truth of the insurrection. I mean, it is beyond. I know that it's gotten. I'm struggling against this. You know. Look. At this RNC meeting, they're going to declare her Republican opponent to be the actual nominee without even having the primary or something like that. But I mean, there's no discussion of Trump's behavior. It didn't come up. There was no suggestion that they were going to censure Marjorie Taylor Greene, Paul Gosar, Lauren Boebert, Madison Cawthorn for the latest insane bigoted thing that they have said. So the purge is only for Cheney and Kinzinger because there's only one standard in this party, which is loyalty to the orange god king and his obstruction of justice. But, and I tweeted this out, I need to spend a moment on this. Did you read the actual text of the resolution? Have you seen this, Tim?
I didn't read it until I read your morning email right before I came on. So you can share it with the world.
Okay. So this is how the Republican National Committee is describing the investigation into this violent attack on the Capitol that left five people dead, hundreds of people, including police officers, wounded. This is the language. Quote, Representatives Cheney and Kinzinger are participating in a Democratic-led, here it comes, persecution of ordinary citizens engaged in legitimate political discourse. Ordinary citizens, legitimate political discourse. Remember,
this Orwellian not, yeah. Like, honestly.
And it passed, good question. And it passed unanimously. Not one person on the resolutions committee said, hey, you know, maybe some crazy redneck rube congressman is going to say that this was a normal tourist visit or something like that, you know, or maybe, you know, Ron Johnson might say something stupid about it being, you know, just legitimate discourse. But do we really, as the Republican National Committee, want to use that language? And the Republican National Committee's answer is, fuck yeah, yeah, we are all in on this.
Yeah, there's a lot there, Charlie. I want to get back to the Trump part and the lack of condemnation from him, because I think it's actually worse than you laid out. But just on the Kinzinger and Cheney part first, the unanimous thing is really telling, you know, because there are a lot of, how should we say it? You remember the privately concerned from the Trump era, you know, there was you'd get a Bob Costa or a Maggie Haberman story that would have a privately concerned Republican that was not putting their name on the record, but just wasn't so sure that they thought, they were worried that the president had gone a little too far this time. They hoped that he, you know, pivoted back to care about the issues. That was a common phrase. A lot of those folks are like on this committee, right? I mean, now the committee is some crazy people, right? The committee is made up of state party chairs and state party national committee women, and men. So it's sometimes, you know, grassroots MAGA folks from the states. But, you know, it's also sometimes people hold that role who, you know, have had a position within the party for a long time, and it's an honorary thing, and they're, you know, your traditional establishment Republican types. So a lot of these, you know, types who've been around the committee for ages, Ron Kaufman's an example. This is a guy who was Mitt Romney's aide-de-camp, longtime Massachusetts guy. He's been on the committee for ages. You wouldn't have thought Ron Kaufman would be a coup guy, right? I'm just using him as an example.
Right.
And he's the type of person that goes around Washington, you know, still dining out with people, with his friends from both parties. And, you know, anytime the Trump crazy stuff comes up, it's like, well, you know, he overstepped a little bit there. there was none of that. There were no objections from any of the quote-unquote good Republicans on the committee. And there's, you know, almost 200 people. There was not a single person who said no, I cannot sign on to something that calls January 6th legitimate political discourse. Legitimate political discourse? I cannot sign on to a thing that kicks out Liz Cheney, who is a Republican in good standing on every issue. She's not a Tim Miller squish. She's a Republican in good standing, a conservative on every single issue except for the fact that she's not for a Donald Trump autocracy. Like, that's it. Yeah. That's the only. She was even with fucking Trump all the way up until he tried to steal the election. And there's not a single person on the committee that says, wait a minute, like, this is too far. And that is a cult. I was happy to see Romney and Cassidy tweeted about it this morning. But, like, that's it. Like, you have a committee, 168, you have 168 people. That is a cult that they have signed a blood oath to Donald Trump, and they are the representatives of the Republican Party. Like, we all knew all this, but that is still pretty, the unanimousness of it.
I know.
Is really something.
So, you know, there's been a lot of, I think, wish casting about, you know, Trump's grip on the Republican Party seems to be loosening. And there's a couple of data points. You can point to a couple of polls, the fact that some of the Trump endorsed candidates aren't raising a lot of money. But I think that what's happening in Salt Lake City, where the RNC is meeting, is kind of that reality check that, no, they are still completely in his thrall. And also, they're just not going to move on. I mean, it's clearly there's only one litmus test, and it is his airing of grievances. But I do sense, and you tell me, I mean, again, I confess that I probably am not a fair broker because I still suffer from PTSD over the last 6 years. But I sense a little bit of frustration among Republicans, or maybe I'm projecting, that they think they have some good issues. They think they're going to win this year. And a lot of them would like to move on. Remember, that was the reason for getting rid of Liz Cheney, is that she kept talking about it. Why won't she move on? And clearly Trump is saying, no, you are not moving on. This is it. You know, 2022 is all about relitigating this. 2024 is all about my grievances and relitigating all of this. And there have to be some frustration among Republicans saying, oh, good grief, we have all of this other stuff we could be talking about. And yet this guy is going to force us to keep coming back to the big lie, to the obstruction of justice, to the coup over and over and over again. What do you think?
Well, yeah, there is that frustration, and you can see it. You can see it, and here's how they're dealing with it. You know, the Republicans who agree with the way that you framed that question, you know, they're just trying to pretend like he doesn't exist, right? Yeah. Like, they're, and this goes back to the Sarah Longwell article from a couple weeks ago about the parallel universe strategy, right? Right. And it's working. And so I think that there's sometimes some frustration, you know, with people on the left, you know, that's like, well, why are you talking about this? And people in the media, there's Trump fatigue. And I want to get to this in a second. Why are you talking about this? But, like, the Democrats, as a political matter, need to wedge, to figure out a way to break that parallel universe strategy. And this, and these sorts of things, the RNC type, you know, action is just one, you know, arrow in that quiver, right? Because, like, they cannot be allowed to get away with this, right? Like, there are a lot of Republican candidates. I wrote about David McCormick in Pennsylvania. There are a lot of these Republican candidates that are going to try to do the Glenn Youngkin two-step on this. They cannot be allowed to get away with the National Party unanimously siding with the domestic terrorists. Absolutely insane. It is far beyond the pale from what we've seen from, I mean, both national parties are kind of kooky and, you know, have strange resolutions from time to time. Like, this is another matter entirely.
And it was completely voluntary as well. There was no need for the Republican National Committee to weigh in on this at all. So,
But just really quick on the media thing with Trump, because you know, we joke and laugh. It's like, well, the committee didn't censure the guy that tried to seize the ballot boxes. But I don't know. I haven't been on, you know, now in 2 weeks with you, Charlie. So all of the revelations that have come out in that time, you know, both some of them weren't even revelations, both from Trump, you know, saying, you know, in the statement that he wanted Mike Pence to overturn the election, to the New York Times story saying that, no, it wasn't some outsider's random memo. It was Trump himself that was, you know, suggesting that they seize the ballot boxes. I feel like the reaction to this has been, maintains, you know, continues to be under stated across the board. I you know, obviously the Republicans aren't doing anything. The good Republicans, even, you know, Mitt, these guys aren't saying anything. But the media, I just don't know. I sometimes I think it's hard that Trump has just created this environment of crazy, the farrago of crazy, as you like to say, that, you know, prevents, you know, that makes it hard for the media to judge what's news, what's not news. But like, you know, if you had told me 10 years ago that a former president of the United States would admit that he attempted a coup, like, you would think that would have been fucking front page news in every paper in the country for a while, for days, maybe. But it was like, it didn't even make the paper in certain places. You know what I mean? Like, people just sort of moved on. Another crazy statement from the orange guy in Miami. I don't know. I've been pretty disappointed with the mainstream reaction to it. I think there's a fatigue that's related to it, but it shouldn't be.
Yeah, I think there is a fatigue. So there's a development that, let's not spend a lot of time on to wait to see whether it actually plays out. Huffington Post, is it SV Date?
Yeah.
Is reporting, he's a good reporter. He's reporting that former Vice President Mike Pence today is expected to rebut again claims by Trump that Pence could have overturned the election to let Trump remain in power despite losing the election by more than 7 million votes. So, you know, Pence had been scheduled to speak to the Conservative Federalist Society's conference in Florida, and some of his advisors are saying that he's likely to respond there to Trump's latest attacks. But, you know, Pence, you know, will often disappoint, so let's not get too far ahead of ourselves. But I think that's going to be an interesting development. It's going to be very interesting to me to see what Pence says, because, you know, look, the guy's not going to be president of the United States. He's not going to win the Republican nomination, but he's right there at that pivot point of deciding how he wants history to remember him. And he's got a defining moment that could actually be one of the kind of profiles in courage for democracy. I know that certain people disagree with me about this, but, or he could just piss it away and, you know, figure that there's some way to get himself back into favor in Mar-a-Lago. But I don't know what he's going to do. We'll see.
I think he's going to keep finding a way to make nobody happy. I don't know. I went to see him in South Carolina, his first speech back, first time he was supposed to distance himself. And, you know, he pays lip service to disagreeing with Trump on the 6th, right? And doing the right thing. And I'm sure he will tonight in front of the lawyers and say that there was no legal standing for me to do this, and that we should stop, you know, trying to advance things that are outside the law. But it's within this context of how great the Trump administration was writ large, right? And the man still thinks he can be president.
Yeah.
I find that preposterous, but he really does. The people around him do. And I think that he will continue to offer this kind of limp noodle pushback. Right. That, like, where he says, I guess he says the right thing in narrow, you know, if you just read one sentence in a newspaper article, but broadly, you know, he doesn't push back. And it's like, where is the emotion? And this man sent a mob to try to kill you. And yet he's still going to talk about how he showed broad shouldered leadership and just made a bad judgment call in this Electoral Count Act. I mean, it's like, I guess it's courage, and it's like, it's the limpest courage ever.
I am not betting against you on all of this. So, have you seen the movie Don't Look Up?
I have, yep.
Okay. I was thinking about it this week. I mean, there are flaws in the movie, and I don't want to get into whether it was a good movie or a bad movie or anything, but it did nail a couple of things. So, of course, for people who don't know, there is this comet headed straight for Earth. It's going to destroy all life and everything. And there are people trying to warn about it, but one of the things I think the movie does pretty well is showing how the media will always get distracted by some sort of a, you know, celebrity squirrel off here that they're really obsessed about, this one empty-headed celebrity, whether she's breaking up with her boyfriend or everything. I kind of was feeling that way this week, where we have the former president of the United States announcing, yes, I actually did try a coup. You can handle the truth. He's actually standing up there and saying it in real time. And here we are going, so let's talk about Whoopi Goldberg and who Jeff Zucker is diddling and stuff. It's like, and you know what I'm saying? It is a perfect example of the way that we have all these big things out there, and yet what sucks up most of the oxygen? So can we spend like 15 seconds? Whoopi Goldberg says something stupid about the Holocaust, is suspended by ABC after apologizing. Should she have been suspended?
I don't care. Yeah, I don't care. The whole thing is insane, Charlie. Who cares? It worked out kind of as it should have. A celebrity has a talk show. They said something stupid. They got pushed back on. They get off air. You know, they hear the pushback from people. They're like, yeah, I guess what I said was pretty stupid. They said what they said was stupid. The network suspends them as a CYA.
15 seconds
left. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Sorry. Then it's over. Who cares? This is not a threat to fucking free speech or anything. Like, this is all fine.
Well, and also it's just so ridiculous because it accomplishes nothing, but they have to go through the performative motions of all of it. Look, it's The View, where you have celebrities on talking about things they know shit about. And so, hey, amazingly, you know, on The View, somebody says something stupid, end of story. Okay, so
can I do one more thing about who the worst people are? Kind of like Whoopi, but the worst people in this whole thing are the people who are obsessed with cancel culture and who now have to performatively be like, I also don't think Whoopi should be canceled. And it's just like, nobody's canceled. No, Joe Rogan's not canceled. Whoopi's not canceled. Everybody's fine. Like, we do not need to have a big article in the National Review about the end of free speech. Everybody's fine. Nothing happened. It's like, everybody is okay. Some people said something, one opinion, other people disagreed. Some people said something stupid, they apologized. It's the world is continuing to spin on its axis.
Okay, so should I be pissed about this?
Who?
I just got an email.
Okay. Uh-oh.
So your first reaction should be, you're reading emails while you're talking to me on the podcast?
Yeah, that was a good stick I just had right there. A good little bit. You're not even listening to it. That's nice.
I figured, this is one of the advantages of having you on, because it's like, Tim Miller, go.
Put it in the quarter.
I can go off, do stuff and everything, and come back and know that you've had this great rip. So actually, Bill sent me this.
Okay.
Some guy named, should I even try to pronounce his name? Vivek something. Just put out an email saying, announcing my second book. Dear family and friends, I'm excited to announce my second book, Nation of Victims. The book will be published in September. I'd be grateful if you could pre-order it. Big headline, Nation of Victims by Vivek. That's my fucking book title. I wrote The Nation of Victims in 1992. Come up with your own goddamn title. You can tell. Okay, well,
imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, Charlie.
Okay, so it's a little bit more serious. The fall of Jeff Zucker at CNN. I would normally say that, just another one of these celebrity weird things. But you know, 2 points about it. Number one, it just doesn't seem to add up that much that he claims he is resigning immediately because he had a consensual affair that he didn't disclose. Punishment fit crime. Obviously, you got all the Cuomo stuff. It's all messy. But number two, I'm sorry, I just can't have a pity party for Jeff Zucker, given the role that he played in, I suppose you could say, in the attack on democracy. But he's the guy that put Donald Trump on television with The Apprentice. He's the guy that made the decision to air those rallies wall to wall. His legacy is, I'm sorry, I can't be part of the fan club.
It's horrible. I'm even worse than that. I'm an anti-fan. In addition, he's the guy that put Jeffrey Lord on TV and sent a car up to Pennsylvania every day so he could come down and do lies on behalf of Donald Trump. And then as JBL wrote in his newsletter about hired Corey Lewandowski 3 days after he was fired as campaign manager and when he had an NDA. The whole thing, JBL posited that it was, you know, white affirmative action, and there may be some of that, but I worry that maybe he has some kind of effect over people. I mean, like, apparently there was this big uproar at the CNN DC office, where otherwise smart people were like, we're really mad about this on Zucker's behalf. Apparently, there are Democratic Congress people that have been calling CNN folks saying they're worried about our democracy's ability to survive. That might be bullshit. That might be bullshit. CNN PR. I don't know. But like, I don't get it. He's just a TV producer. Like, he's a glorified TV producer And you know, their ratings are going down. And you know, the network has turned into a lot of talk, which is fine. But I think that there's some argument for pivoting back towards, like, you know, more news gathering and doing things beyond, you know, chatty panels. And I just don't see it. And his actions in 2015 and 2016, I'll tell you, Charlie, I don't think I've told this on this podcast before. I had one of the nerds that worked for me on Jeb's campaign go and look and count the number of times Jeb had been mentioned on CNN between Trump's announcement and a certain date. It was like in the fall. And they were mad that Jeb wasn't coming on more. And I was like, you want to know why he's not coming on more? Look at this. And it was like, you know, I don't have the number. I don't remember the exact numbers, but it was basically, let's say Jeb had been mentioned 100 times. Like 78 of the times what was Jeb saying in response to Trump, or what was Trump saying in response to Jeb? 20 of the times were his poll numbers. 2 times were other things. Right? I mean, like, his coverage, their coverage, which was Jeff directed of the 2016 primary, was madness. And it was, Trump was the sun and everyone else was circling around him. It was not just the empty podiums, which were bad enough. And so, you know, I don't know that that's like the reason Trump won, obviously, that he tapped into something with the voters.
Well, it didn't hurt.
But it certainly didn't fucking help. It didn't hurt either. Yeah. And okay, so
for people to remember what you're talking about, the empty podiums, I mean, they were so slavish in their coverage that they would actually have a split screen where they would be doing the news. And then they would have like a shot of the empty podium waiting for this candidate, one of a dozen candidates. It was, you know, if you want to write a history of how the, you know, mainstream media screwed itself, this deserves an entire chapter.
For sure. So, you know, I agree with you. The story seems kind of weird, and it doesn't. I don't know what the real truth is behind the scenes about why he's leaving. But to me, it's been the hagiography of him afterwards that is just mind-boggling. At best, he was a net negative impact on our democracy. He certainly was not a savior of it, and he certainly is replaceable. This weird notion that, like, Jeff Zucker is not replaceable. God help us if Jeff Zucker is not replaceable.
Okay, so speaking of people who are replaceable, you had a really tough piece this week about Chuck Schumer. You broke bad on Chuck Schumer this week.
Yeah, I did.
Did I push you to that? Because I put something on Slack where I said this was just gobsmacking political math.
No, you did not push me into it.
Like great minds thinking alike.
Yeah, it was great. It was an example of great minds thinking alike. As I said in the article, I've had the little note in my little notes that's like, the Chuck and Nancy show, it's got to come to an end sometime soon. I've been thinking that for a while. Not to be ageist, but just with Biden as a combination, the visuals are not great about the party's gerontocracy. But, you know, you wanted to give him some time, and they did get infrastructure passed. They did get the COVID relief passed. He's gotten judges passed. So it hasn't been a horrible record. But since the fall, I just don't know what Chuck Schumer's been doing. And I forget if you talked about it on your podcast or I just read it on his Substack, but Iglesias, you know, also Matt Iglesias also wrote about this, and you guys had a great podcast together where, you know, he's talking about how weird it is that he kept hearing about the fact that Schumer really did have fears of an AOC primary.
Yeah.
And I'm like, if that is really why he's acting like this, if that's really why they did this stupid voting rights show that had no chance of passing, that kind of minimized the importance of this very critical issue, because he just needed to protect his flank from an AOC primary. And that is insane if that's true. And if it's not true, it's just a sign of really bad strategic judgment. So I don't know that it's really possible for Schumer to be replaced before the midterms, but I was hoping that at least would be a wake-up call to, you know, the Democrats in DC who read us, that there needs to be a change in tactic and a change in tack if he's going to be kept around, because, you know, the moves on with Manchin, how he cut that deal with Manchin, that didn't tell anyone about it. For people that haven't seen the background, they signed a piece of paper where Manchin said, Chuck, on BBB, here are my limits, $1.5 trillion max. You know, there's some of these programs I'm not going to be for, other ones I will be for. you know, again, it wasn't the perfect deal for progressives, but it's still $1.5 trillion is still double the Obama stimulus. I mean, Manchin was still given a lot of leg on you could have gotten some big programs for $1.5 trillion and some big feathers in your cap you could campaign on. Chuck cuts that deal with him, then doesn't tell anybody, figuring that he can maybe twist Manchin's arm behind his back to get him to support more. Like, what? And then and it comes, you know, he doesn't
tell, when you say don't tell anybody, doesn't tell Biden
or
doesn't
Pelosi.
Tell Pelosi.
Yeah.
I just like, can't even get doing? My, I cannot even get my head around it. I mean, honestly,
just political malpractice. What are you doing? Yeah. And so then obviously BBB collapses. So here we are. We're back at square zero. His original deal with Manchin is off the table. Whatever they're going to get from him now is going to be worse from a progressive perspective. And in order to cover up for it, he did this voting rights charade. It's been a bad strategic few months for Chuck Schumer, and they need to wake the hell up over there. And so, you know, hopefully, I feel like this is the nice thing about being a former Republican is that we can kind of be YOLO. I had some Democratic friends who texted me, and they're like, I agree with you on this, but if I tweet it, it's like, you know, I get yelled at by so-and-so. So, you know, we have the freedom to do that.
Okay, speaking of being yelled at, do we want to destroy our mentions here? Oh, by the way, I got to say, people who ought to check out your This Week's Not My Party. I didn't know which direction you were going to go on the whole issue of affirmative action and the Supreme Court candidate. And, you know, because, you know, I'm thinking, you know, woke Tim Miller is going to go, you know, all in on all of this. But you had a very nuanced take on it. I thought you did a really masterful job of pointing out the issue, pointing out the hypocrisy of some of the Republican critics of Joe Biden, but also reality check about public opinion on this issue. So I think people should check that out.
Yeah, thanks. It's a tough one. You know, you want people to be like, oh, rah, rah, rah. And so, you know, look, I'm a person who I'm woke to Miller. I am a person who thinks representation matters, and I think it should be a factor. But I do think that in the bubble, in the Twitter bubble in particular, and in the left wing bubble, there is a lack of awareness for how some of the raw identity stuff gets translated by regular Americans. And it's not popular. Some of the affirmative action stuff is not popular. And I think that there are ways to talk about this and to support representation that, you know, is within something that is popular, right? Which is just advocating for social justice and advocating for diverse viewpoints. And like all of that is good. But it's like the quota stuff, you know, rubs people the wrong way.
So speaking of the bubble, apparently there is a piercing of the bubble here. I thought it was interesting. Joe Biden goes to New York, meets with the new mayor of New York, Eric Adams, and is explicit as possible, says, we are not going to defund the police. We are not going to take away your resources. We are not going to leave the neighborhoods unprotected. And of course, you can tell that he's been listening to people saying, you need to say this. But it is fascinating watching some of the blowback that he gets from, you know, progressives in places like New York, who are like, no, Joe, you shouldn't be saying these things, but we'll see where it goes. Okay, so speaking of like destroying our mentions.
Just really quick on this, I want to add one thing, because who else has chimed in on them? And just a name for people to keep an eye on if they're Bulwark listeners, they don't know him, Richie Torres. And we should maybe have him on the podcast or something. Richie Torres is a congressman from up there.
Yeah, very progressive.
Much more progressive than us, but has been really good on this issue and really clear-eyed, you know, in talking about, you know, the importance of balancing safety and also, you know, caring about gun violence. And so anyway, so Adams, you can see, I guess this is why I wanted to mention it, because it is encouraging. Yeah. Just coming off the unanimity conversation with the RNC, you know, it's not good politics to be divided as a party. So it's not great for the Democrats that they're dealing with all this. But for those of us who are hoping for a rationally based party, you know, it is encouraging that there at least is a Adams, Biden, Torres faction that might not be well represented on Twitter.com. But like within the party, within the elected officials and the voters, since they voted for these people, by the way, it's encouraging to see that.
It is very encouraging. Okay, so since we haven't completely destroyed our mentions yet, you were discussing the question of gerrymandering on the live stream last night. And, you know, this is one of those, I actually have like a note for a thing that when I, you know, am feeling up to it, to write a piece about democracy with a small d, democracy with a big D, power and principle, urging people not to confuse all of them. But the gerrymandering issue is, and again, take a deep breath here, is one of these where I understand that Democrats cannot unilaterally surrender. But one of the things we're finding out is that gerrymandering, which has been held up as this existential threat to democracy, It's actually not turning out that bad for the Democrats. In fact, the you know, Dave Wasserman and others are saying that looks like the Democrats are actually going to come out ahead on this, because for every horrible story of gerrymandering in Texas or wherever, or in Tennessee, the Democrats have been pretty aggressive in gerrymandering in New York, in Maryland, and Illinois, and they're probably going to come out net negative. So this is one of those things where, okay, guys, since we're dealing with this existential threat to democracy, which I think is real, where do you put gerrymandering?
Yeah, I put it pretty low, so flame away. But I think this is a complicated thing, so just bear with me. Everybody sit in the rocking chair for 1 second. Let me just explain my view on this, because for, you know, the Democrats are, just as a matter of fact, the Democrats are going to probably come out ahead this time, or at least close to even. Now, they were going from a baseline of a gerrymandered House that benefited the Republicans, right? We aren't going from baseline neutral, because the 2010 gerrymander for really benefited Republicans quite a lot. That said, you know, Democrats have been ruthless in New York and other places, in Maryland, and, you know, the courts have intervened in a few places in Republican states, which is good, to kind of create more fair maps. And as a result, we're going to end up with kind of a neutral or slightly Democratic favor on the 2020 redistricting. Okay, so that said, I think that there should be some changes to the way that we do districts. Like, I think communities should live together, right? Like, the Utah gerrymander drives me crazy. I've mentioned this a couple of times. It's like Salt Lake City, they turn the state into four corners, you know, and so they're like four little arms that come into Salt Lake City and take out all the Democrats. And so then each district can be Republican and have all the people in rural Utah. You know, like, Salt Lake City should have a district. Like, this is the kind of thing that shouldn't be hard, right? A community should have its own district. Like, that's the whole point of having geographically based districts. You know, I would love to see some kind of reform that tries to incentivize competitiveness in districts. I don't know exactly what that looks like. But all this stuff gets complicated. Yeah.
Well, it's complicated because those might not be consistent. Because right. If you keep communities together, given the way that voters have sorted out, that is going to, you know, create these bubbles. And places like Wisconsin, for example, one of the reasons why it's so hard to redistrict is because Democrats are super concentrated in Milwaukee and super concentrated in Dane County in the Madison area. And Republicans are super concentrated in the suburbs. And if you try to draw lines that make the districts competitive, then you break up the community. You can either have, you know, communities of interest, or you can have competitive, but you really can't have both necessarily.
Yeah, this is right. And I got to fight with this on a panel. There was a progressive activist, and I was on this panel, and gerrymandering came up a couple years ago. And, you know, I just expressed the same view I just expressed, right? I think communities should be together. I think we should try to incentivize competitiveness. But then the progressive person in this case disagreed because they wanted, and this is, again, a fine goal to have with districts. They want majority-minority districts, right? But you know, if you're in Texas, for example, to have multiple majority-minority districts, you know, you do have to kind of do one of these silly, goofy things where you split up Houston, right? And so there are two there are two districts, and you draw these kind of weird little maps like you do in New York City to combine, you know, more minority heavy areas with, you know, richer Upper East Side areas or whatever it is. And so you get these kind of funky looking maps. So it's like, are you upset that they look funky or are you upset? Like, what are you upset about? Right. So it's complicated. And to your exact point right there about how we're self-sorting, we are all self-gerrymandering. And I think that there is this view on the left that, like, with if we fixed all the districts, it would help Democrats maybe a little bit, right? And then there's this view in the center that's like, oh, if we fixed how we did this, we wouldn't have so many extreme people in there. It's like, that's not true. Like, Marjorie Taylor Greene's district is not gerrymandered, right? Lauren Boebert's district is not gerrymandered. Like, they just represent insane constituents. The constituents are the problem. They want what Lauren Boebert and Marjorie Taylor Greene are selling. Neither of them are in crazy districts. So, look, I think that there are certain things that we could do, you know, then there'd be a big fight about it. But, like, the answer is the democracy is not being saved by this, right? Like this is not the silver bullet. It's not the magic elixir. It is not the problem. And like, lumping it in with the vote counting and voter suppression and all this stuff, I think is wrong. And I think it's part of the mistake of the Democrat strategy on this from the start.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And again, I understand why Democrats are doing what they're doing. You know, they feel they're just playing, you know, the cards that are dealt them. But power is not the same as principle. And so what happens is it does, you know, lower the credibility issues. You get a lot of eye rolling, but we'll see how this plays out, which is why I keep coming back to the Electoral Count Act. If you want to talk about the five alarm fire, the ticking time bomb that we have to disarm right now, it is the Electoral Count Act and the possibility of a coup. I thought JVL made a good point last night where he said, you know, gerrymandering is bad. It's more like, you know, poison sort of sleeping, you know, seeping into the water. It has a long-term negative effect. But right now, the house is on fire. And I think that there needs to be, you know, a distinction there.
You guys, one other thing. I wrote, I think maybe on Monday, about how, you know, there's this demand of never Trumpers that we all care about norms and traditions, and how I bristle at that because I don't love norms. And like some norms are good and some norms are bad. Like, this is such a prime example of that. Like, in a healthy country with two healthy parties, like, we could just look at this and say, well, let's stop the power politics games. Like, it's not really helping anybody. It's just undermining faith in the system. Can't we all get together and figure out, you know, some basic rules? Not everybody's going to come in with everything they want, you know, for all the reasons we just laid out, because sometimes these things, you know, compactness and competitiveness and representation are at odds, and like, come up with some basic rules and just redo this and see if we, you know, see if we like the next system. And then in 10 years, if there were some unintended consequences, we can tinker with it again. Like, that's how a healthy system would work. And by the way, it is how our system worked for a while, you know, where there were lots of changes to these types of things. And you know, the party power politics has ruined that. And you know, now there's not even like, to even say that is like laughable. Like, you would, like, somebody, if I said that around my friends, like, this is what I think we should do with gerrymandering, like, they would laugh at me and be like, you should be on a no labels panel with that nonsense. Ooh. You know what I mean? Like, how sad is that, that that's where we're at?
It is sad. So anything else you want to rant about before we go into the weekend?
I wasn't ready for that question. I was ready for all the other questions. I had my shtick, I had my riffs. I don't have anything. I'm excited about Joe Burrow.
Oh, well, it's an off week this week, though.
I'm excited about Joe Burrow. Yeah, so we won't get to talk about that if I'm not on next week. I'm excited about the little LSU love, the Joe Burrow to Ja'Marr Chase connection in the Super Bowl next Sunday. I've got a T-shirt. I'll probably be wearing a very obnoxious T-shirt on next week's Not My Party that has Joe Burrow and Ja'Marr Chase's face on it. So I'm pretty excited about that. I'm concerned about Aaron Rodgers coming to the Broncos. That might be something that's relevant for the two of us. I'm pretty concerned about that. I'm going to need a memo from you if Aaron Rodgers goes to the Broncos and how to deal with my mixed feelings about having Aaron Rodgers on my home team.
You know, it's hard to overstate how negative folks are in here in you know, the cheese world about Aaron Rodgers. You know, I actually posted a couple things that were somewhat negative about him, and usually you get huge blowback, like, leave Aaron Rodgers alone, but did not get any of that. So the NFL, two things just, you know, popping into my mind here. Number one, has the league ever had a better playoff series than this one? I mean, look, whatever side you're on, these games were freaking amazing. I think
it's been amazing. Joe Burrow is magical. Is part of the reason, and you know, I do feel bad for Eric Trump, who quit watching football over Colin Kaepernick, so he hasn't been able to enjoy it. That's too bad for him.
And remember, one of the signature moments for Mike Pence was going to a football game and then walking out of the football
storming
game because somebody
out.
Took a name. Yeah, because
I thought it was weird that the wokes won football in the culture war. I never would have seen that coming.
Well, speaking of that, though, I think the NFL's got a real problem with this Flores lawsuit, the racial discrimination lawsuit, and the fact that, I mean, you know, and the whole Rooney Rule, which apparently there was sort of the wink-wink that every team had to interview an African-American, and some of the owners, some of the teams apparently just treated they turned it into a farce, and now they're getting busted on it. So
can I just, because this is relevant to the Supreme Court thing too, honestly, right? Yeah. And it's like the token, they're like, we're going to have this quota where you have to have one person in an interview. Like, people don't like that. Right. Like for this might be latent racism or white fragility, but white people don't like it. They bristle at it. They're like, why should there be an automatic slot? And then obviously, for good reason, people like Brian Flores, people of color, don't like it. So, like, wow, I'm just getting brought in as a show pony for this one interview, and like, and they bristle at it. It's like there needs to be a broader value of we really need to have more diversity and representation, and like that needs to be a broader value that happens to the top, and people at the top should be criticized when they don't fall into that. And that's easier said than done, obviously. But it is crazy. There's one black coach in the NFL. I mean, all the players are black. Not all, but, you know, I mean, 80, 90% of the players are black. One of the coaches is. You know, you can't look at that and not look at the ownership in the NFL and think that there's bias at play. You just can't look at it like that. And so I do think that they're in trouble. And the Bill Belichick goof,
I think it's hilarious.
Is like, you know, just prime, right?
Where that, people who are not following this, Bill Belichick, you know, is texting, and apparently he's not really good at it, so he thinks he's texting another guy, and
Ryan Dable, who's this white coach who gets the job.
Hey, congratulations on getting the job. You're going to be great at this job. And this guy, Brian Flores, who had not yet interviewed for the job, is going, what? And he goes, well, this is what? It's Brian, right? I'm sorry, what was his name? Rabel?
Yeah, Brian, yeah.
So he's texting the wrong guy, making it very clear that he knew that the Giants had already picked somebody, but before they'd even gone through the motions of, oh, man, how do you text the wrong person?
I've done that. So I do get it. So it's maybe one step, you know, old man thing. And another for me is sometimes I get too hot with texting people on my computer on the iMessage. That's dangerous. Don't do that. Don't text people via iMessage on the computer. That's dangerous. You know, it happens. But how much more stark of an example can you get than that? Like, you haven't even had your interview as like the one minority candidate, and the other guy's already gotten the job. And, you know, it's just anyway, good for Flores. Flores probably blew up his career over this, by the way. He's a young guy. You know, people thought he did a good job in Miami. He got fired, but, you know, because the results weren't the same on the field. But he did seem like somebody that'd be up for other jobs. And you know, owners obviously don't like somebody who's going to air dirty laundry. So hopefully it makes a difference. And this stuff's been going on. I mean, it's like, come on, 50 years now. And the Rooney Rule is from the 80s, 40 years, like 35 years this has been going on. And still one coach. It's a sign that the system's broke.
Yeah, you would think so. You know, we haven't even talked about the fact that Joe Biden took out the leader of ISIS.
We should have talked about that.
Hell, we should yeah, talk Joe about Biden. That.
Hell yeah, Joe Biden. That was a good win for Joe Biden, taking out the leader of ISIS. And you know, I don't know. We'll see what happens in Ukraine. I haven't been as negative as everybody else at the Bulwark about the Ukraine stuff. We'll see. I don't know. I feel like they've been, you know, I loved that they were slapping at Josh Hawley over this. And, you know, they seem
to. I'm pro that.
The foreign policy stuff seems to be riding a little bit. We'll see.
All right. Listen, have a great weekend. Tim Miller, thanks for coming back on the podcast. Appreciate it always.
You too, Charlie. See you, man.
And thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back on Monday, and we'll do this all over again.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains September 19th through the 24th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.